Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 158. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
James Jones.
Hey.
And TYP.
Why, hey, oh yeah.
That's Mike Cole.
Hi.
Sitting in for John Lindemann, who is away at some hoity-toity dinner party or something this week. I don't know. He'll be back next time. So thanks to TYP for joining us on this episode, and I specifically wanted him to do it because he, along with Aaron Kaluska, are the biggest Mario experts that I know. And TYP always has something interesting to say about Mario games, as well as Sonic and Kirby, actually. I think that's the triumvirate.
Yeah. Well, I think Aaron is more of a walking encyclopedia than me, but I certainly know my Mario.
Yeah.
I mean, for those who don't know, Aaron Kaluska also helps out with the Mushroom Kingdom, which is is the place to look up things for Mario.
The authoritative Mario website.
Yeah, it's a good place to go, actually. I recommend checking that place out. So, of course, the reason I want a Mario expert on the show is we're going to be getting to retroactive in the second segment with Super Mario World. Some comments from the forums that you wrote. And, I don't know, hopefully a healthy discussion on this classic game. But first, new business. TYP is up first as our guest.
Oh, why, thank you. So, I haven't been playing too many games. I've been busy doing other non-game related stuff, but I've been sampling here and there, and the big thing I picked up a few weeks ago was Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection.
Is it that ultimate?
Actually,
there will never be another one.
Actually, it is not, and I'm actually kind of annoyed with a lot of the reviews I saw before I picked up the game. It's still pretty good value. I mean, I got it for like $28 with free shipping off Amazon new. And, you know, it has a whole bunch of Genesis games. But I have to say the presentation and overall package leaves something to be desired. Took some notes down here. Hold on. Okay, so...
Brace for it? We call these the raging points.
It's... James knows.
Yes, we already had this conversation. Hence the assist on the is it that ultimate?
No, seriously, there are some problems. First off, the presentation overall is kind of sterile. I don't know, kind of bland. In fact, when you're going through the menu, it's kind of static. It isn't like even animated when you move what game you're selecting. But that's a minor quip. The major quip is that it likes to run natively in 720p. So since I'm using 1080p on my PlayStation 3, it has kind of a border around it, kind of like a Game Boy player would.
Right.
And there is a way that you can go into the settings and stretch it or put it to default to, you know, stretch 16:9 or whatever and get a fugly whatever. But by default, it has this border. And the problem is the border is ugly and distracting. And it's different for every game. And some games, it's like, really bright and distracting and whatever. So in order to get something that I want, I have to set it to 16:9 and then on my TV tell it that it's actually 4:3.
Right, so squash it back in.
Yeah, squish it back in. And that's just sort of inconvenient and a really stupid oversight. And the worst part is, you know, there are, whatever, 20 different games, and it saves the settings for your video separately for each. And there's no way to say, like, make this my new default.
Oh, that's no global settings. That's poor.
Yeah, it is.
What about the quality of the emulation? Have you got any sense, although some concern about that relative to how good it is on the virtual console for Genesis? I mean, have you detected anything, or is it just
I haven't detected anything.
Really?
I'm not the most sensitive to that stuff. But I haven't detected anything. That said, I've kind of done a sampling of a lot of different games, and I'm only familiar with a few of them from my childhood. So I'm not the best person to ask for that.
The display stuff is obviously a lot more noticeable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a filter you can turn on, which smooths everything over. You might want it for one or two games, but it winds up reducing the detail because it's, you know, blurring everything. But I mean, you can turn that off, obviously. In fact,
the incredible detail of Genesis graphics.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised. There are some stuff. There is some stuff lost, and sometimes it matters, sometimes it doesn't. It's kind of a personal preference thing. But the biggest oversight in this, and it's something that I really feel I'm kind of cynical about it, is there's Sonic 3 and there's Sonic and Knuckles, but there is no Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
Right.
And I did not realize this before I purchased it. And since that's would have been the thing I wanted to play the most, and I already bought it twice already and I've lost it once on my GameCube, it kind of pisses me off. And the presumptuousness of calling this Ultimate when you don't have the game people probably want the most, ugh. It's kind of annoying. But that said, there is a lot of stuff there, like Dynamite Heady. If you haven't downloaded any of the Virtual Console games, this might be a good buy if you want a 360 or PS3.
Yeah, how many of the Treasure ones are on there?
I think it's just Dynamite Heady. Well, I don't know what all games. It's certainly not Gunstar Heroes. It's not on there. But Dynamite Heady is, and they've got both Shining Force 1 and Shining Force 2. And I don't know if they have all three of the... what's the RPG that...
It
has all four Phantasy Stars? Yeah, so that means...
Yeah, there's a lot of RPG on that disc.
It's still a good value. If there are four games you're interested in playing, and you don't already own in some other convenient form, like Virtual Console, it's a good value, and that's why I picked it up. And I'm not really that bitter, in spite of not having Sonic 3 and Knuckles, because it's good to have this library of games I've never played. And so the only game I've played to any degree... is Shining Force 1.
Yes.
And it's interesting. It's an interesting game.
Uh-oh.
But being used to Fire Emblem, which is a similar game, I really can't get into it. And I haven't played Shining Force 2. Maybe it fixes some of these problems. But the biggest thing is it's really hard to figure out what order the characters and your enemies are going to go. Unlike Fire Emblem, where it's the player's turn and then the enemy's turn, and you can move your characters in any order you want. It's kind of this predetermined order based on statistics, I guess.
Probably speed.
Yeah, like a speed plus maybe the terrain. I don't know. But the end result is you can't tell what's going on. And so you wind up really frustrated because you have to move guy A before you can move guy B, but you really wanted to do it the other way so that you could heal him. You just feel like you're wasting a lot of turns because of the unpredictability. And it's frustrating. And there's also no counterattack, which makes it feel kind of simplistic. So if you attack, there isn't this... Oh, well, gee, I'm an archer, so if I attack and they counterattack, they'll hurt me, you know. There isn't anything like that. So it feels kind of simplistic compared to what I'm used to.
Is there any kind of, what are the RPG elements to it? Because
there are actually more RPG elements than Fire Emblem. And it actually has kind of an archaic menu where you have to push A to open up like this four-way menu for talk or for item. So it's a little annoying because you have to walk up to someone and then push A and then push A again to talk, kind of like, I guess, the original.
So you do actually, explore an environment and talk to characters.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's pretty different from something like Fire
Emblem. Yeah, that's the big difference, I'd say, is you have this town you go to, and I think there's some other places I haven't been to yet that are towns.
Oh, that's very appealing to me, actually.
Yeah, and you go to the shop and you buy stuff.
Yeah, and for me, a lot of strategy RPGs are... too light on the RPG elements, and even games that I really like Final Fantasy Tactics, you technically go from town to town, but each town is literally a menu, and you never directly control your characters,
never investigate
anything.
In fact, this game is almost the opposite, because I got frustrated with it, because after your first mission, on the way back on the overworld, you have to fight guys that are blocking your way, then you get to the town, and you do your thing, and then on the way out to the next place, oh, there are more guys blocking your way. So it's like every step of the plot, there's something in your way. It's kind of small scale, as far as I can tell, everything seems to take place within a pretty small area. I might be wrong. I still haven't played very much of the game.
Well, I'm going to stop you right there, because Shining Force 2 is probably going to pop up in our next retroactive poll.
Okay.
So in the off chance that it actually wins, we might end up talking about it more. So I don't want to get too deep into it before that opportunity presents itself.
Okay.
But I could probably say that for a lot of games that you've been playing on this collection.
Yeah. Well, if one of the games that is on this collection is selected and you own a PlayStation 3 or a 360, consider buying this instead of a Virtual Console if there are a lot of Genesis games you're interested in. Like I said, there are some quirks on kind of a shoddy implementation of user-friendliness, but I haven't found any big problems with the actual emulation. And like I said, I mean, it's a big collection of games.
You know, the size of the collection is actually a little bit of a turnoff for me. And I know that sounds weird.
Too many games!
Well, yeah, I found that in these collection discs and things like that, it's a bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, like I would prefer sort of a guided tour through the game, which is kind of what you get with the Retro Game Challenge, yeah. Although it's probably a bit too guided in that case. But knowing as little as I do about a lot of these Genesis games, because, I mean, I had a Genesis, but I never played that many games for it. So being a relative newcomer to that library, I see a list of 40 games. I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, that was
like,
my problem.
I don't really want to play through Sonic again. I'd like to check out some of the stuff like Shining Force that I'm not familiar with. But, you know, what's the point of, should I play the first one? Should I skip to the second one? What are the differences? Like, and these games are big time sinks too. I mean, there's probably 8 or 9 RPGs on that disc. Like, I don't want to play 10 hours into each one to figure out if I want to keep going. Like, I would prefer a little more guidance, I guess.
Well, which is why we need your nominations for the next poll.
Well done, sir.
Slick.
All right. Well, I've been playing a couple of download titles this week, actually. First is Nyx Quest, Ikarian Spirits or something, Kindred Spirits, for WiiWare. And this used to be called Ikarian Winds or something like that. But they changed the name to Nyx Quest, which is a very ugly looking title, but the game is actually really good. It's a lot like Lost Winds. So it's essentially a platformer, but you're using the pointer and, you know, pointing at the screen and doing things with the wind or controlling objects sort of almost telekinetically. And it's really easy to make the comparison to Lost Winds, which I have played most of, but I think this is actually another step up in complexity and depth, and to me, how interesting it is. Because the thing I found with Lost Winds is that your character can really only move left or right. He can't even really jump, as I recall. I mean, not much. So you never really have to control the character and control the wind at the same time in Lost Winds. You kind of, most of your character motion is done by the wind. It's just a matter of doing the right thing with the wind, and so it comes across being pretty easy. In Nyx Quest, there's more platforming feel to it. There's more of an action feel. Like, it actually takes skill, because a lot of the obstacles and a lot of the pits that you need to cross require you to control the character, meaning not only running left and right, but also jumping multiple times with her little wings. So you're doing all that with the nunchuck. Well, you're controlling with the nunchuck, you're jumping with A, and then you're pointing at the screen and pressing B to do all this stuff at the same time. So for instance, sometimes there'll be a fireball, for instance, that you need to drag across the screen to blow up a block on the other side, except the block you need to blow up is actually beyond the limit of the screen. And so what you need to do is pick up the fireball and then start moving your character so the camera pans with the character, and then keep the fireball fairly close to the center of the screen. You may have to dodge a couple of wind currents or enemies or something like that that could destroy the fireball. And so you're doing two things at once. And it's not that difficult. It's not overwhelming. But to me, it feels like it requires a kind of skill and a kind of attentiveness that I haven't really seen other Wii games do. I guess it's just another example of WiiWare kind of pushing into design spaces that the retail games kind of aren't.
Kind of promising to me, because I think, you know, when you think of Lost Winds, and kind of people drew the analogy with Kirby's Canvas Curse and all with the touchscreen and the stylus, the sort of indirect control. But the great thing about what you've got with the pointer on Wii is much more feasible to have like a kind of meshing between the two as direct, you know, analog control with the sort of supplementary pointer function that obviously with the DS, because the way you have to hold it would be asking a lot for you to manipulate the D-pad, say, while doing some of this stuff with the stylus. It just wouldn't be very comfortable. But of course, with the Wii Remote Nunchuck setup, it is possible, and it's kind of a little overdue for someone to do something where you really kind of take advantage of it in quite that way. I mean, obviously, a Pro Evo did it for soccer.
And Super Mario Galaxy did it to some degree.
It's very supplemental in that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Galaxy 2 is going to bring more of that with Yoshi.
It looks like it with Yoshi's tongue and some of the other stuff. That's cool. And of course, Sin and Punishment is going to do it as well.
Yeah, and you know, beyond the interesting controls, Nyx Quest is just very well designed. It's basically an action, it's kind of a puzzle platformer, I guess you would say. So there's a lot of how do I get across this pit with all the different enemies and things like that. And it, you know, the character doesn't seem to have a lot of abilities, but you kind of learn to use them in some not obvious ways, I guess, over the course of the game. It seems to ramp up in difficulty very nicely. It's not too easy, for sure, but it's not super hard either. And it does have pretty nice graphics, I think. It has a good art style, and the music is very, very pleasant as well.
And what about structurally? Obviously, Lost Winds was more of a Metroid style, whereas this is this level by level?
It's more level by level.
Right.
The levels are not necessarily completely straightforward. In some cases, you may have to backtrack for part of
it,
or take a different route to get back to a door that you passed earlier, or something like that. And there are quite a few secret items hidden around the levels that are very, very challenging to get to. They seem to be completely optional, but I've actually passed by some that I just couldn't figure out how to get to, and I just moved on and figured maybe I'll go back later and try to get all of them. But it is primarily level to level, though. Yeah, and the levels are pretty long, it seems like, or at least it takes me a while to get through them. So it's a slow paced game, but I'm glad that it is, because I think it would be overly difficult if it was faster. It's more of a take your time, think about what you're doing, pay attention. It's very impressive, actually. And it's only $10. It's a great thing about this stuff is that, you know, you can get really interesting experiences for not much money. And speaking of that, the other game I've got this week is Trine. This is another 2D platformer, another 2.5D platformer, I guess you would say. This one I got for PC, and it's supposed to be coming out on PS3 at some point, also for download. But I don't have a PS3 anyway, so that was a non-issue. And I guess they've said that they eventually want to bring it on Xbox Live Arcade, but it'll probably be quite a bit longer wait. And I had played the demo for this on PC and didn't really feel like it would work as well with a controller. So Trine is a 2D platformer. It has beautiful 3D graphics, very, very nice high-definition type graphics. But it is essentially a platformer, and it plays pretty much like Lost Vikings. Now, that's maybe not a great description, since Lost Vikings is a very old game at this point.
It's got enough resonance with at least some of our listeners to recommend the game.
Good. But anyway, the idea of the game is that you control three different characters in this 2D platformer, but because they've all touched this magical object called the Trine, their bodies are all merged together, and so basically all it means is you push 1, 2, or 3 on the keyboard to switch between them at any time. So you're controlling one character, but you can just immediately switch to another character. It's kind of like changing uniforms in Mickey's Magical Adventure on Super Nintendo, you know? So you can switch between, a wizard, a thief, and a knight. The wizard is really cool. You draw with the mouse pointer. This is why I don't think it would work all that great on a controller. But with the mouse pointer, you draw, for instance, like a square on the screen, and it'll create a box of that size in that location, which you can use for platforming and solve puzzles and stuff. And you can also, if you right-click, you can drag that box or a lot of other objects around on the screen. And with the thief, you have a grappling hook, which is really fun. I always love grappling hooks, especially in platformers. And she shoots bow and arrow. And then the knight is not as interesting, but he's really powerful. He just has a sword and a shield, so he's good for combat. Otherwise, you wouldn't use him as much. But the interesting thing about the game, about Trine, is that it's a physics-based platformer. So there are a lot of puzzles involved that require you to kind of move objects around to weigh down levers and platforms and things like that. A lot of times you can stack up objects to get up to high secret places and stuff like that. There's some interesting kind of contraptions built into the levels that you have to figure out how to make the physics work in your favor so you can get around them. And there's a lot of imagination to it. And I haven't really played a 2D platformer like this that relies this much on physics, and also that has graphics that are this nice. So it's kind of a nice mixture of art and mechanics. And I really like it. It started out as $30 on Steam, but now they've got a discount. It might be over by the time people hear this, but they dropped the price 25% for a week, and that's when I picked it up. And they'll probably do so again at some point. And there is a demo on Steam, so I do recommend, if this sounds interesting to you, look up Trine, because I think it's pretty awesome. And it'll be interesting to see how it works out on the consoles. I mean, it would be, in terms of control, it'd be great for Wii, because you just, instead of the mouse, you could just point at the screen. In fact, that would work even better than the mouse for a lot of the stuff that you're doing in this game. But graphically, this would not play on Wii. They would have to, I think for one thing, it would be way too big for WiiWare, so it would probably have to be a disc game, and they would have to rework the graphics quite a bit to make it run on Wii. But I still think that would be a worthwhile endeavor. I just don't know if it would be marketable. But James,
yes,
give us an update, please.
So I am almost complete my world domination in Little King's Story.
You sick bastard.
I think there are two more kingdoms that have to fall before I'm done.
Yeah. You had trouble getting the blood off your hands?
No, actually I quite enjoy decimating entire kingdoms in my wake.
Assimilating their culture.
So what I'm going to say is that after the first two bosses, which I think is how far I had gotten last week, mm-hmm. the game just gets massively harder. And at that point, no boss is normal anymore. So the first two bosses were mostly just beat the crap out of them. Mm-hmm. Boss number three, and it's not spoiling it because every review on Earth has mentioned this, is a pinball game. the boss is rotund, and you have to bounce him around.
Dama-bama.
It feels quite a bit like that. And you have to bounce him around by throwing your soldiers at him until he loses enough weight that you can spear him on a fork. It is the most infuriating boss battle I've ever played.
This is actually like Odama.
Yes.
It's like a cute real-time strategy game mixed with pinball.
Yes. But it's not just like, oh, this is a pinball. There's like blinking and flashing lights. There are Oni, which are the general enemy in the game, moving around with signs in the background that you can hit for, and these like fireworks go. It's psychotic.
Wow.
It is painfully hard boss battle. And in fact, it's so hard that I went back out into the menu, set the difficulty to easy after about the 4,000th failure, played through it, still lost the first time, and then played through it again and won, went back and set it back to medium and left it there normal, as I call it, for the rest of the game. It took 2 days just to get through that boss battle. Let's put it that way.
Oh, man.
I think that's divine retribution for the suffering you've imposed on other kingdoms.
I really hadn't imposed that much suffering at that point.
This was early on.
This is what...
I think the causation's backwards there.
Yeah, this is what causes my willingness to cause suffering.
Ah, okay.
Well, this is really scary to me, but I think you've probably just convinced Greg to pick this game back up.
it gets weirder, though, because...
I'll get to it.
Because a later boss battle... I think it's the last one I just cleared, is it comes in the form of a geography quiz.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've heard about this. It's so bizarre.
Basically, the enemy king is the king of, what is it called? I think it's called the Couch Potato Kingdom.
Wow.
And it turns out that he is a body in a suit, like a TV presenter suit, and his head is a TV. And everything he does is in the form of a TV broadcast.
I'm confused. What era does this game take place in?
It's set somewhere between the Renaissance period and maybe the early age of enlightenment.
But in a parallel world where everything's completely insane and turnips...
and there's a pinball.
Yes, and turnips are a legitimate threat.
Are you saying this boss battle is like the final round in Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
No, not even close. It's much trippier than that. So I didn't realize what was going on until the first time I failed. So there would be these holes, and I have these dots on the ground, and I have a member of my party who's capable of noticing where there are secret places you can dig stuff up. He was going crazy as we walked around this map. Well, the screen. It turns out it was a map. I didn't realize that the first time, so I thought, oh, that's where I need to dig to find the boss after he disappeared. Basically, the whole screen would vanish for a second, come back, and I would be in, quote, punishment zone for failing. And just crazy shit would happen. Like, a UFO would chase around my people. Knives would, like, fall from the sky. Like, baseballs would come flying into the screen. It turns out they were TV channels. One was like a sci-fi channel, one was a cooking show, one was a sports show.
But this wasn't made clear to you before? I mean, you're just thrown in there and expected to figure that out?
Well, if I had noticed that the ground was a map. So it turns out the ground in front of his throne is a map of the world, and these red dots are cities. And while he's talking to you, he's giving you hints what city he's in. So he'd make a comment about, like, you know, this is on a mysterious island. It's part of Chile.
Oh, so is this a map? This is a map of the real world.
The real world, yes. Just to make things even crazier. So basically, you have to figure out what he's talking about and dig him up. Meanwhile, he's, quote, gone to war with you, and he's got these miniature tanks coming out, and these soldiers who are on the ground, like, crawling with guns, trying to stop you from digging him up. And then after about 10 seconds of that, airplanes start flying overhead and dropping bombs and carpet bombing formations. It is the most bizarre thing I've ever experienced. But there's no actual fight with him. Once you get him, you get to deal damage for a little bit, and then you do it all over again. So he himself isn't threatening, but figuring out the puzzle is. So as you beat these bosses, you, quote, rescue these princesses they've captured, and you take them into your kingdom as, quote, your wife. Which is weird because you're only, like, 8. And it's weirder because I now have 4, quote, wives living in a house next to my castle. And at one point, I got a suggestion letter from one of my records minister that read, quote, I've noticed how many times you've visited the princess estate. It's a very large number. People are going to talk.
This game makes Baby Yoshi cry.
I was just like, oh my god, who the hell is this
rated
game?
T for teen.
Who the hell is this game?
Earning it.
Yeah.
Oh man.
It's funny because the game starts out, it's pretty innocent. And it all makes that turn when you're...
You really thought the innocence was going to get maintained as you turn a bloody coup of the entire planet.
It all turns when you're when it goes from defending your little fledgling kingdom to your minister of state announcing, all right, time to take over the world now. It really turns, and it gets just weirder and weirder and more inappropriate.
It's just going to end up a lot like Scarface, I think. You know, he's going to have a machine gun with a grenade launcher on it and get shot in the back. That's what I'm thinking.
It's so...
Die, Robotnik!
It's almost... it's almost dark sometimes, because one of the bosses has an alcohol problem. And when you beat him, he's like... He basically makes a comment when you go talk to him afterwards that this is worse than his alcohol problem. I'm like, jeez.
Oh, man. This sounds fascinating.
It's such a weird game. I mean, I'm having more fun with it than I was a week ago, but it is truly bizarre.
I think now that Little King's Story has inoculated the American Wii audience, it's okay for Nintendo to release Devil World on Virtual Console.
I don't think it's that far yet, but there's some questionable stuff in this game.
Oh, man. I still look forward to playing it. All right, Greg. Finish up new business, please.
Yeah, in terms of what I've been playing, I picked up for pretty cheap Ninja Gaiden Dragon Sword. It's got some, in addition to its subtitle, some kind of strangely early DS kind of things about it for a game that only came out last year. For instance, some nice blowing on the microphone kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's really token. It's just kind of annoying. But in general, it's pretty well put together game. I guess you could say this is the second part of our Better Know Your Metroid developer series on RFN. as we sort of scrutinize them as they take over mine and Johnny's favorite franchise anyway. But it's a very straightforward game, basically. It's totally linear, it's short, the combat is all stylus-driven, it's not that sophisticated. It's not completely unsophisticated, but inevitably with that kind of interface, it can feel a little bit random. There's not a whole lot of variety in the enemy designs. The gameplay is very monotone.
That sounds just like Ninja Gaiden that I played on PlayStation 3 and stopped playing halfway through because I got so damn bored and frustrated with it.
Ouch.
I haven't played any of the recent ones on the other consoles to compare. But, I mean, there's no platforming in it like there would have been in the NES games or anything like that. I mean, you play with this sort of Resident Evil style kind of graphical thing with the polygonal characters and the static backgrounds, which it looks quite... I think it works better in some ways on a handheld system because it's all a bit smaller and the sort of incongruity of the two things is kind of hidden in the low-res environment to some extent. Although I think they probably could have done with a little more with the lighting effects to make it look a little more integrated at times.
Well, the lack of platforming is a pretty major departure from the console Ninja Gaidens, I mean, throughout the history, because even if you go back to, you know, I'm not sure about the arcade version because I haven't played it, but even the NES version is, I would say, as much a platformer as anything. And Ninja Gaiden Black on Xbox is very much a, you know, it's not strictly a platformer, but it has quite a bit of platforming in it. That requires a good bit of skill and is pretty interesting, I think, in terms of running on walls and doing jump combos and things like that. So I can see how taking those elements out would make just the fighting. I can see how that would
become
sort of
I mean, that is mostly what you're left with. I mean, it's a little bit like, in fact, No More Heroes, if you took out all the open world stuff. Structurally, it's kind of like that if you just had those 10 missions, because all it's got is like a sort of very simple hub world that you just level up some of your abilities at between chapters, and that's about it. So it is very simple, but I guess the thing about it is, being a handheld game, it's kind of, it is fun enough that it's quite easy to be able to play in a short burst. You know, the save points are pretty liberally distributed for the most part. And so, because it is generally a lot easier than the series reputation, that's for sure.
Well, I think there's a super hard mode, though, that...
There is, but it unlocks. I mean, I've played it all the way through on normal, which doesn't take very long, because it is pretty easy and it is pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't be particularly inclined to replay through it anytime soon, but, I mean, I might give it a go at some point, just, you know, if something to play on the train or whatever, because, I could imagine it could benefit from the extra difficulty. Is probably a little too forgiving. You can be a little indiscriminate with how you control it and stuff, just because of the balancing. And it's good. I enjoyed it, certainly for the price that I got it. Yeah, I think if you paid full price at the time, it wouldn't, because of the shortness of it and the sort of very one note gameplay, you might have felt a little shortchanged. But there's some redeeming features. Certainly, the bosses are very impressive graphically. This is the one time where it actually goes into full polygonal 3D. So you've kind of got a complete sort of battle arena to fight in, and it runs very smoothly, it looks good, and they play, you know, more interestingly than the standard sort of more hack and slashy bits that sort of populate the levels, but there isn't much of a progression curve with them, really. They don't get particularly more sophisticated, they don't get particularly more difficult. They're always sort of nice when they come along, but they never feel like they're ratcheting it up, especially as you level up your abilities and all that. I guess it just kind of moves in line with them and therefore stays still, if you know what I mean. So,
yeah, I remember when this game came out, I don't really recall hearing a lot of complaints about its length, but then if you think about it, I mean, back in the early days of DS, people were paying full price for Yoshi's Touch and Go, which would be probably a DSiWare game now.
Yeah, because it's just a score attack game.
It's pretty much a mini game with a leaderboard.
This is certainly a lot more robust than that. I mean, don't forget, I mean, this only came out first half of last year, so certainly standards had moved on by then, and there were some...
First half of 2008?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, John talked about it on the show, episode 94 and 96.
Good grief! What do you research this shit before we start?
Well, I have a long memory, and I could re-cross-reference these things. But...
No, I mean, I vaguely remember him talking about it, but yeah. I thought he picked it up quite a while.
No, this was at the time. He even, dare I say, it flirted with the idea of reviewing it, and if you go on our site, it got an 8.0 from a rather more timely Zachary Miller in the end.
let's not insult John while he's gone. I'd like to show him more respect than I get when I'm absent.
He's still holding it in the one episode.
No, it's every time. It's every time I'm gone. Well, you guys make a lot of funny jokes about me, and they're funny.
Well, so there we go. Then it's perfectly acceptable as long as they're funny.
Oh, yes.
I make funny jokes about John when he's here, so it's not a big difference.
Yeah, but he can defend himself.
Talk good, guys. So good. That's my impression of Lindy. I don't know.
I
Lindy, look at me.
Wow. Okay, I shouldn't have said anything. I've only made the situation worse, apparently. I tried, John. I tried.
Also, just coming today, got the Classic Controller Pro I was talking about last week, and I've just put it through the pace of a bunch of different games. Got to make sense, Sin and Punishment, Space Harrier, Geometry Wars Galaxies, Klonoa, a bunch of other stuff. And it feels really nice. The distance between the analog sticks being extended is kind of important for me, especially playing Geometry Wars Galaxies, because you don't get that thing where you kind of ram the analog sticks together and then just bang your thumbs together, because that, for, I've got pretty large hands, and that was a problem. I kind of have to play with my thumbs resting as little on the sticks as possible, basically, before.
Yeah.
Whereas now, yeah. I don't feel like I have to think about that at all, so that's definitely a big plus for that kind of dual-stick gameplay. For everything else, the D-pad reminded me, I have only played a DSi once at the London E3 event thing, and it definitely reminded me of that. It's sort of a bit more depressed in the centre and a little more clicky feel to it than... Mm-hmm. Than the D-pad on the classic controller, and it feels pretty nice actually. It's not too clicky, because I'm not a big fan of that. So it feels like a pretty good medium, and obviously it's a lot bigger than the one on the DSi, so it feels really nice. And the shoulder buttons have been changed; they haven't got that analog sort of thing going on anymore.
Mushiness.
Yes. So which I think for the vast majority of games that you would ever use the classic controller for is what you want, because they're going to be like virtual console mm-hmm. games or whatever. You want the immediacy of just the press.
Right.
So that's good. And I mean, the form factor, very ergonomic.
You can actually reach the Z buttons now, right?
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, because they're just like, DualShock style now.
The mushy triggers on the original classic controller, that was always such a bizarre design to me, because, you know, they were patterned pretty much on what the GameCube controller had done with its triggers. And unfortunately, the analog triggers were never really used very well on GameCube, beyond one or two exceptions that I can think of. Mm-hmm. And then to put it on, to replicate that on classic controller would have made sense if you could play GameCube games with the classic controller.
Which you can't. No, I mean,
since you can't, it's completely insane.
No, I mean the only times that it would be used, I guess, is for your original games that could use the classic controller, have a traditional control scheme that you would map it to.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a pretty small subset of games.
There was no indication that any developers were crossing their fingers that the next Nintendo controller would have analog triggers with a click at the bottom.
I always liked the soft feeling buttons, though.
Well, I didn't have a problem with the feel, but if you're playing virtual console games, you want the button to respond like as if, you know, it did on the Super NES, for instance.
You want it to be digital. And the other thing is, I think the softness, the analog triggers make a lot more sense ergonomically with the way GameCube did it, where it's actually depressed, like a gun trigger, not this big, fat, mushy button that has really just feels like it has too much play. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't feel like
it
doesn't feel like a natural motion, really.
That for me again is an improvement. Like I said, you know, it's very comfortable to hold. It's still quite light because obviously it hasn't got any of the rumble stuff in it and all that kind of stuff. But it's got a little more heft, a little more bulk than the original. So it's got a pretty good feel to it. And just it's pretty much the ideal kind of traditional controller, really. I can't imagine much more. I mean, so I do like the kind of placement of the GameCube analog sticks for games, you know, for dual analog games, having them, you know, totally separated. But obviously that's kind of not the main point of the classic controller, and now that they're further apart, they're perfectly fine both on the lower part of the controller. So it's really nicely done. I guess we've got Monster Hunter to thank, really, but it's kind of great that they actually went back and fixed it.
I find it strange how you guys complain about the classic controller, because I've never had any problems at all.
Me either.
I'm using the classic controller as a SNES controller most of the time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. See, in that case, it wouldn't be a problem. But if you're playing Geometry Wars, then it's a different matter.
Okay.
And then, you know, the other stuff is just little things, like, yeah, the wire coming out of the bottom instead of the top.
Oh, God.
It's just
I've seen people actually
things.
Mod their classic controllers to change the location.
It's not
of
like
the
it's
port.
Really a big deal. I don't understand that. I mean,
it bothers the shit out of me.
It's just, it's just a minor annoyance, but I think it ticks all the boxes for me for what I was looking for out of it, so I'm pretty happy with it, and it looks very nice in the black.
Did you get a black remote to go with it?
No, I don't need an extra remote right now.
Yeah, I'm kind of annoyed, because I was really hoping they would announce a color while it was in Japan, so they didn't have to get a white Japanese Wii. And of course, like, they announced it like a few weeks after I got back from Japan.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, so, and it was just at the start of this month that they actually launched it.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
So I'm not as bitter, but it's still kind of
furious.
Annoying. Then again, I wouldn't have gotten the same good deal.
And the last thing I'll briefly mention, we'll certainly return to this next week. But what I got with the Pro in my import order was Chibi-Robo, new play control from Japan.
Your first time with Chibi-Robo?
Yeah, first time I played Chibi-Robo. So I like skip stuff that I've played, so I thought, yeah, this would be pretty cool.
You're going to love
in
it.
In Japanese?
Well, the thing about it is that because it was a kind of a big import hit relatively back on the GameCube, there's extensive kind of facts and translations and things that you can look up.
Okay.
As it already exists, so it's not really a big problem, and I don't think this is ever going to come out in the West, the new play control version.
Yeah, that's really sad. It's so good.
He could be wrong, but you know, it just seems like they've kind of wrapped that up now, and Chibi-Robo's been left out in the cold. But anyway, the only thing I've got to comment on it is that you may remember at some point, I think it's a story sort of on Silicon Era, and you know, I assume it came from a Japanese magazine originally, and we picked it up, that it had point-and-click controls as was apparently original concept for the game, that you would sort of, you know, you wouldn't directly control Chibi-Robo. But this is in fact completely untrue, because I've played the game today with an analog stick. I mean, the point, it does not work that way. So I don't know where the wires got crossed.
Good. I like total inaccuracies and
very, very odd indeed. Yeah.
Maybe it's an option you can flip in the menu.
Well, I've explored the options. The only options that there are for rumble and stereo and stuff. Clearly, when you're dealing with Japanese text or whatever, I could be missing something, so I'll concede that though. But it certainly isn't the default control scheme. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, go learn Japanese and come back and confirm it for us next week. Now, we're going to take a break and come back with Super Mario World Retroactive. Okay, welcome back. It's time for Retroactive. We're going to be talking about Super Mario World. And once again, I want to thank everybody who voted in the poll. It was very, very close. And we had a ton of votes for all the games, really. And Super Mario World just barely won. But I hope everybody is going to play along with this, contribute to the forum thread and the discussion. And the nice thing about this game winning is that, you know, it's not like Ninja Spirit, where if you didn't vote for it, you probably, you know, aren't going to buy it, and then you're out of the discussion. Super Mario World, I feel like almost everyone who's listening to this has probably played it, so hopefully everyone has some context for what we're about to jump into here. Even if you're like James and think that there's really nothing interesting to say about it.
That's not what I said. I said that it's more interesting if it's a game that we all haven't played before, and I think that
Ninja Spirit, right, guys?
No, because I said that is a failure on the part of our listeners.
Well, regardless, Super Mario World, it is a game that everybody's played before, a little bit like Zelda 2, I think, although this one's even more ubiquitous. But I feel like there's more to it, and going back to it, I'm up to like halfway through the third world, so I haven't even seen half the game yet. But it has been a very long time since I played this, and even though, as Greg mentioned during the break, like I can remember all these weird details about enemy placement and secret hidden blocks and stuff like that. I feel like there are a lot of less mechanical, like more aesthetic things, more kind of overall subtext that I never caught when I was younger.
Exactly.
And going back now, having, you know, learned how to be more critical of games and thinking about game design and having played all the games that came after Super Mario World, I'm seeing a lot of stuff, and I think my general opinion of it is that it's very weird. Like, is it just a really weird game? And that never really struck me when I was a kid.
But aren't all Mario games pretty freaking weird?
I mean, everybody's joking about the mushrooms and, you know, what are these guys on, stuff like that. But Super Mario World is, I feel like it stands out in such a way that, you know, everybody thinks of Super Mario Bros. 2 as being the black sheep of the series, and they you know, it's very easy to make that argument because of the whole Doki Doki Panic thing and retrofitting it with Mario characters. But I feel like Super Mario World is just as off-kilter from the rest of the series as 2, if not more so. And it doesn't have that kind of game-switching, redesign story to it. I mean, it was designed as a Mario game, and yet I feel like it's, in a lot of ways, a pretty big departure from what came before it and what came after it.
I think some of it is because of how close it came out to Mario 3, because obviously it was, I think, at the end of 88 in Japan, Mario 3, and then at the end of 90 for Super Mario World. So that was kind of the, you know, 2 years, pretty short sort of period for a mainline Mario game, especially when you're going onto a different platform. And there are, you know, very significant similarities between the two games, but they tried to differentiate it in a number of ways. I mean, they made some pretty smart decisions in terms of, well, you know, it would kind of be pointless to just try and do Super Mario 3 exactly the same, just with better graphics. So they did go with bigger and more open levels, and the sort of the power-up system, they sort of went more sort of streamlined rather than this myriad of different suits. They kind of pared it down to a few things, and of course Yoshi is a dynamic power-up. He can eat certain enemies and gain different abilities on the fly and things like that. So I think in some ways it's, you know, relative weirdness is because they probably felt, well, look, you know, Mario 3 is this huge success and it's very fresh in everyone's mind, and we do want to do something, you know, that is significantly different, at least in some aspects.
I think you're absolutely correct, Greg. And you know, I actually hadn't played this game in maybe 5 or 6 years. I think last time I played it was for the Game Boy Advance when I was reviewing it. I play Super Mario Bros. 3 maybe every year, every 6 months even. And I played Super Mario World when it first came out for like 3 months straight. It was like the only game I had for the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, me too.
I think a lot of people probably have that experience, didn't they?
But since then, it's not a game I go back to as regularly. And so this time I really had a fresh set of eyes on it. And I was amazed. I really felt like Nintendo had a vision for this game where, like, we want to make something that's more like an adventure. A lot of people have called this an adventure platformer in the forums, and I think that's absolutely correct. And everything about it, you see all sorts of little design decisions that, like Johnny pointed out, when you first start from the very beginning, you have a choice. Do you want to go left or do you want to go right? And the map is so well integrated into all the levels, you know, the branching paths are reflected in the maps. You can kind of say, oh, look, there's probably something over there. And, you know,
that's
subtle
right.
little hints.
Yeah.
It's a world unto itself. And even much more so than Super Mario Bros. 3's worlds, it feels like an organic composition. And it's little design decisions like this, little things about, oh, you notice something, but you can't get there yet. You have to hit the switch and then you go back. And you can play the level again and get the second exit. Little decisions like this, little decisions like slowly easing you into forcing you to discover secret paths. Like in the Forest of Illusion, they force you to eventually have to discover a secret exit. And it's a way of introducing you to this huge mechanic. They have secret levels within secret levels within secret levels. I mean, so this is really some epic shit there.
Isn't there one ghost house with 3 different exits?
That sounds plausible, but I certainly haven't played enough of it to actually say that just now. My experience this time has been playing on my original cartridge, and I've been able to A, sort of go through the game. I've gone from the start and beaten Bowser, but also play some of the secret stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess the first thing that I guess you notice really, it's still kind of mesmerizing to think that Mario 3 didn't have a save, because it is really big. But obviously this is bigger and it did have a save. I think that was some of, you know, they felt they could put a lot more of these adventure-y kind of things in, and all these different exits and replaying levels that you've already beaten and all this stuff, because you had a save. And so that, you can't kind of really underestimate the impact that would have had on the design, as well as the experience of playing it. It wasn't just a convenience thing. They actually adapted the game design around the fact you had it.
Now, Greg, you're playing this on a Famicom cartridge, right?
The Super Famicom.
Super Famicom system and everything.
Yep.
See, I'm a little jealous just because, and this may be a strange story to tell right now, but I remember when Super Mario World came out in Japan, I was reading about, you know, I was reading previews and stuff, and, you know, I was a big Mario fan, and the idea of it being on a new system, in my mind, opened up the possibilities so much that it was almost incomprehensible to me how this game would look and and play. And I remember very vividly having this dream around that time that my family had gone on vacation to Japan, which my family would never, ever do. Ever. That's way too adventurous for my family. My family's idea of a vacation was to go to Atlanta and go to the Coca-Cola Museum. So anyway, in this dream, I got to play the Super Famicom and Super Mario World before any of my friends back in America. Mm-hmm. And it was just this euphoric experience. And I woke up, I could have felt sad that it was all a dream, but I actually remember feeling up, feeling like, oh my God, that was the coolest dream. And I felt like I had really
nice.
Played it. And what's amazing is that at the time I had that dream, Greg was actually playing the
this
game.
This is
on his
true,
own
yeah. So I've told the story before.
That's why I'm jealous.
Our NES broke very early in its life, and it was like, well, you know, it was kind of depressing to think about having to replace that. And so we, in the end, managed to just go straight to the Super Famicom. And in fact, we not only had it before everyone in America would have been playing Super Mario World, we had it before people in Europe would even have been playing Super Mario 3.
Wow.
Let alone when the Super NES eventually came out in, I think, 92 is when the Super NES came out in Europe. So long, long, long way in front of everyone else. But, of course, having played the Japanese cartridge, if I'm really bad with the names and all the stuff in there, because I haven't got... I still don't know what half this stuff is called.
Mm-hmm. Greg, you would have been a very popular kid at my school if you had Super Mario World before Super Mario 3 even came out. I mean, when I remember, I got my Super Nintendo the day it came out in America, and I took the instruction booklet from Super Mario World to school and showed it off to my friends to prove that
I had
Super Mario World.
Nice.
Yeah, and those were really exciting times.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, that's the thing, though. I guess the point with the playing the Japanese version, though, is that it kind of heightened the kind of mystery and about everything, because, you know, it has things like hint boxes and stuff, you know, stuff that was new to the series, but obviously you couldn't understand any of it. And so all these secrets, all this really obscure stuff, I've no idea how much that's like aided.
No, it's almost none of it. I think this game, like, we go back to, you said the save really allowed you to alter the game, how Nintendo designed the game, and in that they could have this really obscure stuff that you discover months after you started playing the game, and it was because you could just say, okay, well, tonight I'm going to sit down and find this secret here. I mean, even after getting the 96 coins, there's still secret areas that I discovered that weren't secret exits, but were just secrets.
But just little nooks
like,
and crannies
things. I think I've discovered a place that I bet very, very, very few people have actually seen. In the mini fortress for the Forest of Illusion, at the very end, when you have the boss door, you can actually go over, and there's this gigantic lava pit. I mean, we're talking really long lava pit. And what you have to do is you have to fly with the spin jump, and you have to be able to hop on the fiery, you know, what, I don't know, the fireballs, you know, the things that hop up and down.
Yeah.
And you have to bounce on those as you traverse this long fiery pit. And you just get rewarded with some one-ups. I have to wonder if there was a secret exit at one point that they chose.
Yeah.
You know, this is too hard, you know. But that was the last thing I saw in Super Mario World, and I felt so proud of myself when I finally pulled that off, because it's a real bitch. So there are these little places, even beyond the second exits, that are really cool in this game.
Oh, there's so much crazy stuff where you're like climbing over the top of the stage. Basically, you're like moving off camera.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of stuff that you did in Super Mario Brothers to find warp zones.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really crazy stuff. I mean, the one that everybody remembers is on the cheese bridge, where you have to fly under the goal and then spin jump off Yoshi to get to a second gate that's behind the first one.
You could do it other ways.
You can. You can do the fly.
Yeah, you can just use the cape.
Whatever you want to.
Yeah, where you sort of oscillate in midair.
Yoshi's the easiest way
Definitely.
To do it.
Yeah,
I'll
Yoshi's
it
the easiest way, but that is very cruel. I knew of the spin, the extra jump that Yoshi could do, but because it was a character, and because it was Yoshi, and I still love Yoshi to this day, I couldn't do that to him. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I was playing that level last night, and like, I really did try to do just the cape fly under, but eventually, like, screw
it's
it.
It's so hard.
Bye bye, Yoshi.
It's so hard because you essentially have to gain altitude, the cape, so you kind of have to dip under the, right. the first gate and then kind of gain enough altitude to get back up, and that's very hard to do, the timing.
It is, but it, I mean, it's one of a few cases where there's multiple ways to do things as well. You know, there'll be so in some cases, like, well, maybe you could do it by using the cape or whatever, but say, for instance, if you have a Yoshi that you've brought in from another stage, you might just be able to eat a purple enemy that will give you wings, that will give you temporary flight, that will then...
Not in that level. They intentionally don't have any turtles in that level. I noticed that.
Yeah,
so
I tried
to do that. I even had Blue Yoshi in there to help me out.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's the thing. It's one of the interesting things I could see, you know, now, looking back on it in retrospect, is that there's a kind of foreshadowing of what they've done with the 3D Mario games in Mario World from the point of view, it's almost a kind of pick-your-own-difficulty kind of aspect to it.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different ways you could kind of play it. Obviously, you could just run straight to Bowser pretty much. And as TYP says, it does actually make you introduce you to the idea of the secret exits, the alternate exits, as a necessary part of the game in places like the fifth world, the forest. Mm-hmm. But it's not a big part of it like that. I guess it's meant to sort of more entice you into experimenting. Yeah. But still, if you just want to go straight to Bowser, that can be pretty straightforward and it's pretty easy. It's certainly easier.
And you will not discover the charm of the game if you do that. And I think there was a forum post I saw from someone who was basically saying this game sucks, and I got the feeling reading the forum post that that he just wasn't looking for the kind of gameplay that Super Mario World was interested in providing. If you're looking for like kind of just a straightforward get to the end of the level platformer, yeah, Super Mario World may not be the best choice. You know, this isn't a Sonic game.
Well, and it's not Super Mario 3, which is much more about that. It's about
To some extent. I mean, Super Mario Brothers 3 definitely has its share of tricky, puzzly levels, especially in World 6 and 7, the ice and pipe world.
It does, yeah. But for the most part,
those were kind of the inspiration for the entire Super Mario World concept of exploration and puzzles.
Did a different sort of riff on it. And I mean, even in specific cases, for instance, think about the switch blocks. They're usually secreted somewhere. When you hit the switch, that means that certain sort of vacant spots in all levels of a certain color will be filled in with blocks. Mm-hmm. And they do all sorts of things. Obviously, the yellow and the green blocks provide power-ups, but they'll block in enemies. They'll give you more of a platform to jump on. They'll bridge gaps that weren't get where you bridge before, get you to one-ups or secret areas in other cases. It's kind of this persistent effect, and also it's kind of like it makes things a bit easier. So I guess for players, if they were stuck on something and they could see some of these block outlines, they could think, okay, well, perhaps I should go back and just like, you know, explore, try and find another one of these and see if that helps me out. Yeah. I think so. That kind of flexible difficulty was something that I don't think, certainly I'd been in Mario quite like that before, and probably not in very many games.
Well, and on the other side, you can actually make the game more difficult if you intentionally avoid the switch.
Yes, yeah, like precisely.
If you leave the switch blocks turned off, you get into more of that zone where some of the secret exits become very tricky.
Certain castle levels would be much harder you're talking about jumping on one block instead of three. And that kind of reminds me of the latter Marios where if you want to beat Bowser, you just get the 60 stars and that's that. But if you want to go for it all, there's a great deal more to see that's a lot more difficult. And so I think in that sense, it really did. It was something that they carried forward into the future games, which again, it really was a decisive break with the save function from the kind of arcade style of the first one.
Yeah.
James.
Yes.
Your thoughts on Super Mario World?
I kind of enjoyed the ghost houses in general more than most people, I think.
They're interesting.
Yeah, I like them.
See, everybody I knew also thought they were pretty obnoxious because you constantly had to deal with the fact that you're being pursued.
Well, and also, I mean, I think what's interesting about them from a design point of view is they are deliberately obtuse.
Yes.
I mean, that's like the point of them. It's like, okay, well, there is no obvious start point, end point to this level. There's always some little trick and doors that don't really go anywhere, or you think they don't go anywhere, but actually they do. And it's just sort of mind games that is very unusual.
One thing I had forgot about the ghost houses, as well as the towers and the fortresses, is that you can't take Yoshi into them.
Yeah, you have to dismount.
It really makes me feel a lot more vulnerable
Yeah.
When I go into those stages, especially because those stages tend to not have checkpoints. So if you die, you have to start all the way over, which I think is kind of punishing. I think that was probably unnecessary.
There are checkpoints in some of the castles.
Yeah, a lot of the castles have secret checkpoints if you go an alternate route.
It's funny you should mention that because there's always this irony about things like that. So it's like, okay, so if you're really quite gifted and you can find this sort of secret checkpoint, it's like, do I really want the checkpoint in that case? I probably don't really need it. You're giving it to the wrong person. You know, right. What I mean?
That's a good observation.
It's like, you played this game for 1,000 hours. We'll give you this ridiculous weapon that kills everything. It's like, obviously I don't need it now. it's this weird reward structure that's in a lot of games. But they're kind of fun to find just for the hell of it.
Mm-hmm. And the same goes with the one-ups, which a lot of people in the forums brought up the observation that
you don't need
this
them.
Game really throws out one-ups like candy at a parade.
Well, and you can go get them.
Star Road 2, where you're given basically the entire level is you grab a star and you kill fish to get one-ups. That's the entire level. If you play it correctly, quote-unquote correctly, the way it's kind of designed, you're basically chaining up like 50 lives right there.
But I mean, not just that. There are places outside of levels that just give you one-ups.
Yeah, it's very odd because its lives have never been less important in a Mario game at this point, given the structure of the game, the saves and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only time is like, I guess when you're playing through and you might have a 3-level span between one point where you can save and another.
Yes.
And so if you were to complete 2 levels and then run out of lives, you wouldn't just restart right there. You'd have to do those 2 levels again. So that's the only time where lives are kind of an issue, but it is so rare. It's just weird that there's so many clever little things to get lives. You know, most of the time it's just not particularly
incentivized. That's probably why they're willing to give them out, because they don't
really I guess because it doesn't really affect the balance of the game. But I mean, think of the dragon coin. Yeah, I mean, these are almost like a sort of forerunner to the star coins in New Super Mario Brothers. And so there's quite a few of them are located in quite tricky areas. So if you wanted to get them all and get the one up, you might have to take a sort of unnecessary risk. And yet, why would you do that when the reward is just a one up? Whereas the star coins in New Super Mario Brothers are how you unlock other secret levels. So it's obviously you're going to try and get them.
And that's true of like the flowers in Yoshi's Island as well.
But of course, again, with the flowers in Yoshi's Island, you get that to get a score, which you get if you get a perfect score and everything, you unlock a secret level. Yeah. With this, it's totally like unimportant. And yet kind of fun to just muck around with.
I like the challenge of going after the dragon coins, but my problem with the way those are implemented is that the map screen doesn't tell you if you found them all for a certain level. And I wish it would, because that would kind of encourage me to go back and replay levels and say, oh, I really want to find that one that I missed last time.
The Game Boy Advance version of this game does do that. However, I believe the Game Boy Advance version of this also has the dragon coins sometimes in different positions.
Oh, weird. That's too bad.
To be honest, the Game Boy Advance remake is interesting, but I've found that, one, the audio is really botched, and I really don't understand why, but it sounds horrible.
Good.
But it also introduces Luigi as being completely different with the higher jump.
Yeah, kind of lost levels, Luigi.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that was a really neat addition, because it changes a lot of the mechanics, but it doesn't look as good, it doesn't sound as good, so I'm actually really enjoying playing the original version a lot.
And yeah, the real deal.
Yeah, it's the real deal. It looks better, it sounds better.
I suppose we should mention the sound, because I mean, I know that was a big thing for me. Every Super Famicom game I added, the sound kind of early on just blew me away. But the great thing about this is obviously like the instrumentation sounded really great. You had the piano and the drums and stuff like that. But the dynamic music, I mean, for the first, must have got to be one of the first times that was ever happened, where you get on Yoshi and it introduces the little drum riff into everything.
Yeah, it was a big deal back then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's something that we get pretty used to now. Certainly, the Mario series has carried it forward. You think Super Mario Galaxy, even though there's a lot of orchestral stuff in that, they retained a sort of dynamic element to it as well. It was all part of the fact the game felt so much more alive than 8-bit games.
Well, I think that's a nice evolution of something that Super Mario Brothers really pioneered with dynamic music, because, you know, on the NES, it's hard to just add an instrument.
Yeah, because you've only got so few in the first place.
In Super Mario Brothers, I think it had to be one of the first games where anything you did in the gameplay affected the music at all. And it's not that it's building on previous songs, but you think about, you know, if you get a star in Super Mario Brothers, all of a sudden you get new music. It's a temporary thing, but it really gives you a sense that, oh wow, I'm way more powerful now. I can do things that I couldn't do before. And then also the fact that once your timer starts getting low, the music speeds up and it gets really anxious. And not only are you affecting how the music is played, but the music at that point begins to affect how you play the game.
Right.
And that is incredible innovation when you go back and think about it. I think in Super Mario World, by that point, they were so used to doing this kind of stuff that they started, okay, let's take it to the next level. You know, let's use the same songs, but we're going to make them sound different based on what you're doing. And it really was a nice step forward, I think.
And of course, I think the biggest thing is that it uses the same melody for the vast majority of the game. But I think some of the reason why they may have done that is not a dearth of creativity, but so much as they had a sound hardware now where you could have instrumentation that was so appreciably different that you could use the same melody but sort of reconstruct it, twist it around, so it would sound very different. Mm-hmm. You know, so you think about the castle theme versus, you know, your standard sort of chirpy first level theme. They do sound totally different, but it is the same melody.
That also goes back to this conscious decision that the team working on this made of, we want to make something that's cohesive. We want to make something that's one world, it feels like it belongs together. And the having the same music, I think, really reinforces that feeling of, this is a world. This isn't the Mushroom Kingdom. This is whatever, Dinosaur Land, or whatever the official name is. And
it's fine to reuse, you know, music themes, I guess would be the best word for it. I like that to an extent, but I do like to see diversity in composition.
It's very different from, you think about Mario, even for the original Super Mario Brothers, you've kind of got four core melodies that are used, which is more. Super Mario 3 sort of expands on that considerably. Mm-hmm. Again, so yeah, it was a departure, no doubt. But, you know, I mean, it's not as if there aren't other melodies in the game.
No, I recognize that.
They have them for the different spots on the overworld. Which is kind of strange, because you're not going to hear them very much.
No, and that's just it. That's what doesn't make sense about it.
It's a little strange, but I think it kind of, the end result kind of works. But I mean, if you're playing it for as long as I was playing it as a child,
you probably drove your parents insane.
It may well have done, and even I kind of noticed by the end of it. I think
it is very cheery music for the most part, but I found that to me the music in Mario World is not as memorable as it was in a lot of the other games, and I'm not exactly sure why
I
that
agree.
Is, but for me, the music in Super Mario 64 is actually probably more memorable, and by that time, they had really gone to even yet another level of, like, putting in guitar riffs and stuff like that, where it really, some of that stuff really stands out, and I guess maybe it's just the kind of music that I like, but when you start putting electric guitar riffs in the music, it just stands out more to me, and you know, I appreciate the music more in 64. But I will say that in Smash Brothers Melee, the banjo song,
yes,
when you're on the Yoshi's Island level with all the pipes and everything,
perfect.
That is incredible.
Yeah,
absolutely incredible. And it made me like that song a lot more than I ever did back when I first heard it in Super Mario World. So I think in some cases it's not so much the compositions that aren't that striking to me. It's just the kind of, maybe the sound chip that they had or the samples that they were working with for a launch title weren't really, they weren't really matching up with the complexity of the music.
Well,
I think
there's a lot of ambience going on as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite a bit. In Vanilla Dome, those levels, the music is way in the background. You just almost can't hear it.
Yeah, it's because it kind of goes down to a low kind of, you know, sort of beat, and sort of the melody's a lot more subdued in the mix. And of course, they would add things to the sound effects, like it would sound like you were underground. When you, even the jumping, the coins, everything
that's
had this kind of
echo
effect on it. Yeah,
that's a good point. Okay, well, let me get to some forum comments here. We're not going to get into a whole ton of them. There has been a really good participation in the forum thread, and I encourage that thread on its own merits. Don't just post a bunch of stuff in there in hopes we'll get in the podcast. I hope you'll read what other people are saying and actually have a real discussion. But I did want to pull out a few comments here. No Name 2200 seems to maybe like the game a little less than we do. He posted, "I'm starting to remember why this game was my least favorite 2D Mario. Don't get me wrong, it's still a fun and well-designed game. It has some variety, and it has 99% of other platformers beat. The problem is that, compared to the NES Mario games, world just seems to lack imagination. The first Mario had an Italian plumber stomping his way through an army of evil turtles in order to free a land of mushroom people. The second, quote, Mario game was a trippy journey through a dream world. Mario 3 had a ton of bizarre power-ups and themes. By contrast, World just feels like a by-the-numbers platformer." I pulled this out because it's hard for me to understand where he's coming from on this.
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, I guess, first of all, the final levels of the game, the special worlds, the Star Bros and all that, they kind of are definitely where it goes more nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they really are. Like, it kind of feels like they were holding back in the more main part of the game, and then they kind of they let themselves go there. So, I mean, yeah. I guess maybe if you are just looking at the more main part of the game, I could kind of see it. And I think it's also this kind of perception is the flip side of what TYP's talking about, in the sense that the game tried to be more sort of continuous and persistent than previous Mario games. It didn't want the same sort of incongruity and craziness of Mario 3, where you just, you know, the overworld map was a sort of almost like an abstract board game, and all the world themes were just crazy, and there was like Little Big World and, you know, all this sort of off the world stuff that Super Mario World got away from.
I think the imagination was allocated elsewhere is really what happened. The imagination was more in where can we shove in secret exits.
Yeah, like the cheese bridge thing. I mean, that is creative, and it's very,
and
very clever.
I think part of it
was
a very prudent decision on Nintendo's part, realizing they only have a year and a half or whatever to develop this game, and they said, well, we can't develop all this different artwork. And so I think in some level there was a budgetary or schedule type, we're gonna limit some
stuff. I disagree with that. I think actually where I really find this criticism hard to identify with is that to me this game has maybe the most imagination out of all the 2D Mario platformers, and that when you launch into this, really for the first hour or two that you're playing the game, there's very little to identify with from a fan of the Mario series. I mean, you jump into it, now you're not in the Mushroom Kingdom anymore, you're in Dinosaur Land, and all the enemies are completely different. You don't see a Goomba until like well into the second
region. And they look weird.
They look really weird, yeah.
They're proto Goombas or something. They're from the Neanderthal Goombas.
There's something.
You don't hear any of the familiar Mario theme song. Mario feels different, you know, he's slipperier. I mean, there's just, to me, it is so different from the start that it's almost jarring to go back to
it. And they kind of work their way backwards, though. They kind of get cloaked because they bring in, they bring in the Goombas, they bring in the Lakitus, and then of course you've got the references to Mario 3, like the sunken airship towards the close of the game.
Oh, yeah. And there's stuff like P-switches and...
Yeah, so, I mean, it kind of works its way back there. And, I mean, even the special worlds, in a way, are kind of a culmination of that, because some of those are kind of smaller levels and just, like, you know, very difficult, more action-y. Right.
Yeah, but to me, there's no lack of imagination, like No Name says, but I also don't feel like it's rushed or that they're recycling assets like TYP sort of implied because of a short development time. I mean, to me, it feels much fresher than, for instance, I mean, Super Mario 3, a game I love, and I don't want to get into this war of which one is better, because I don't care about that question, but I do think there are a lot of interesting points of comparison, and to me, Super Mario Bros. 3 is much more leveraged on all of the elements that were introduced in Super Mario Bros. 1 and maybe a little bit from 2. To me, Mario 3 is more like, okay, we're going to go back to the same place, we're going to do a lot of the same stuff, but we're going to tweak it and add a lot of new craziness to it. Whereas Super Mario World, to me, is more of a complete reinvention. It's more of a, all right, we're going to step completely to the side here, and we're going to create a whole new place full of whole new things. And, I mean, that's not even necessarily a good or a bad thing, but to me, it requires more imagination because mm-hmm. they're really kind of starting from scratch in a lot of ways.
I guess the thing is, it's more fresh in that sense. He's trying to create a coherent kind of world. It depends what, if it's his open interpretation, what you think of imagination, but you could think of some of these more off the wall things that you see in Super Mario 3, like, you know, the sun chasing you around. Or,
oh, yeah. No, there's no lack of ideas
in Yoshi's 3. Island, like the touch fuzzy get dizzy thing, or, you know, some of the wackier stuff that isn't really, Mario World isn't that wacky,
yeah,
apart from maybe some of the special world things.
It's pretty dry, and
it is more straight, it is more down the line, you know, for whatever reason, than some of those elements.
But there's so little familiarity with the previous Mario game, especially at the beginning of Super Mario World, that I really like that. I mean, I feel like it sets this game apart from the rest of the series, and it kind of makes it more interesting than some of the other games.
Well, and I still think it was especially crucial at the time of its release.
Because of the conditions. But at the same time, I completely understand why some Mario fans would feel put off by that.
Yeah, because, I mean, sometimes you don't want it messed with, you know, if you really love something.
But then you get something like New Super Mario Bros. That looks really generic. I think that although there isn't as much variety in the locales in Super Mario World, I think that the art direction, it looks really good. I think I like the textures on the ground and on the walls and the subtle parallax scrolling, and all that stuff looks more, I don't know, tangible than the pre-rendered stuff found in, say, New Super Mario Bros.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Super Mario World look, too. I almost can't help but like it. It's such an important game for me. It's very difficult for me to look at it objectively at all,
yeah,
to be honest.
True.
I'll concede that, but with I almost fault New Super Mario Bros. More for that, because I'm not a fan of that plasticky pre-rendered style. It's not. It's devoid of flourish. It's pretty soulless, to be honest. But there you go.
All right. Well, let me get to a couple more forum comments, and some of these kind of mirror the things that we've already talked about. Like Gojira posted, "When I first saw Mario World when retroactive, I was a little disappointed. I've played this game 1,000 times, and I couldn't really think of what I could say about it." James, is this your alt account? All right. Anyway, continuing, Gojira said, "But I've been replaying the game on my SNES, and the thing that stands out for me is the puzzle aspect to the levels. All of the multiple exits to the levels usually require extra thought to figure them out, and I love that aspect to the game." And this really ended up being kind of part of a series of forum posts where people started talking about the more adventure-y feel, like saying, you know, something like Mario 3 feels like more of a straight action game where it's just about thrills, it's about challenge, it's about, you know, giving you obstacles to overcome, and so where Super Mario World feels more about exploration and things like that, and as we said earlier, a lot of that is enabled by things like the save feature. Mario 3 was more about not only being a straight shot from the beginning of the game to the end, but because of the length of the game, you know, just like in Super Mario Brothers, you start to look for ways to actually skip areas. Whereas in Super Mario World, I feel like most people playing the game really wouldn't want to skip areas. In fact, when you do accidentally skip areas, you want to go back and figure out how to be complete about it and how to actually scavenge every single little thing.
I mean, and I guess that there's a couple of things here. I mean, first of all, the exploration aspects, all these different secrets, it kind of makes you want to explore everywhere. And of course, that's going to send you on a lot of wild goose chases. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, you know, it's a bit of that Super Metroid kind of thing as well, you know, where it's like something could be anywhere, so you mm-hmm. just want to look everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of makes it really exciting. It's really not obvious where the next secret could be, and it's just kind of exciting to think that sort of anything could happen. It feels more spontaneous. But on the other hand, there is an element to which, you know, these things are not completely obtuse. For instance, the Cheese Bridge secret, there's a visual clue.
Yes.
Because the sign that has the pink arrow that's normally in front of the crossbar that signals the end of the level is actually behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So then you know that if you spot that, you could say, "Oh, well, hang on, that's unusual."
Right,
and they have red circles.
They have red levels for ones that have secret exits, and there are other visual cues that, oh, look, there's like a path over there. I wonder how we get over there. And the game actually really does a good job of teasing. Like if you find one of the secret exits in the donut plane, you go to the ice level. you all of a sudden you get to see the very last world, you know, or with Bowser's castle, and you're just up on this little ridge and you can't get there, but it's like, ha-ha, look what you have to look forward to, you know, and that's pretty cool.
Nice foreshadowing.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Pandarius posted about the fact that Super Mario World feels easy to him, saying that some of the changes make it feel like a much friendlier game than its predecessors. For instance, the bricks were gone, and instead you have blocks that spin before becoming solid again, so you can't screw yourself out of reaching a high power-up. And Yoshi acts as a shield of sorts, giving you essentially one more health point in addition to the power-up you can hold in a box.
Yeah, which is another addition, that made it a bit gentler, having the reserve power-up.
Well, but then on the flip side, B-Boy said that it actually seems harder than he remembers. Mario seems slipperier, and most of his deaths are just sliding off a platform. So
I think that he may have input lag problems there, because when I first started playing on my HD TV, I had the wrong setting, and it was impossible to play. I was running off cliffs like crazy, and it was because I didn't have it on the game setting mode.
Yeah, and I've heard the GameCube controller may not work too well for this, so if you're on Virtual Console, you might want to use your Classic. But I do think Mario is slipperier in this game than he was in 3, especially. I mean, I think there's a little bit of a slide to him.
I always like that. I always like the more sense of inertia. And I mean, I know one thing that I was rubbish at as a child was not holding the damn run button down. I couldn't help myself, when it made no sense to keep it held. But the one thing I would say is because of this so many lives and because you're saving, you can play it like an idiot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you can throw lives away playing foolishly, and that's kind of fun, which is not really something you do when, you know, the lives matter.
Mm-hmm. No.
So in that sense, it's almost kind of, it kind of makes the fact that he can die in certain ways, you know, less of an issue because the structurally the game is more forgiving.
Yeah. Well, I think it would mean that you would be more inclined to just dick around and do things that probably aren't good ideas.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And experiment as well, of course.
And one observation I'm just making right now is that the fact that you have lots of lives really helps you when it comes to exploring. You don't have to get too worried about, like, well, let's see what's down there, what's over there, you know? You can do stupid shit when you're exploring and not have to worry too much about it.
That is the beauty of it, the sort of change in the structure of the game. And, you know, I mean, there's various ways in which, the blocks, as we said, they're not so easily destroyed. So that can help you continue to experiment. Although you can destroy the blocks permanently with the spin jump.
But from above, not below. Really strange.
And he actually kind of goes into an indefinite sort of drill.
Yeah.
Which comes into play in one of the star levels in particular. There's like a sort of maze of drilling.
I like that level because it shows one of the interesting sort of expansions on the 2D platformer that was, I think, introduced with Mario World, is that the stages tend to scroll in all kinds of different directions. Whereas I feel like, from what I remember of the last time I played Mario 3, in that game, even though you could double back on yourself, which was a problem in Super Mario Brothers, each level is available for you to move around freely, but most of the levels just go from left to right, and in maybe almost all of them.
Yeah, there are a few exceptions.
A couple. But Super Mario World, you're much more likely to play a stage where you start at the top and the goal is to get to the bottom. Or there are some sections of levels, maybe not entire levels, where you start on the right side and you actually go left, which is just a brilliant subversion of the whole concept that Miyamoto created himself with Super Mario Brothers, which is the left to right scrolling. I really like that. I mean, it's kind of a simple thing. It doesn't make the game play dramatically different, but it kind of changes your expectations, I guess. When you go into a level, you're not really sure what you're going to be doing.
Yeah,
and I like
that. Of course,
there's
all this vertical real estate with, you know, built around the cape, primarily.
Right, and there was some precedent for that with the raccoon suit.
Sure.
Yeah, oh, there certainly is. I mean, the cape is... I feel like the cape is more sophisticated than the raccoon tail. You've got...
Not as much fun, though, to me.
It's not as free, but there's more of a skill to actually doing stuff like the cheese bridge trick, if you do it that way, or you can do the little dive bomb and kill all the enemies on screen and things like that.
It's definitely more difficult to use than the raccoon.
Yeah. Well, it's more complex.
Because it's more of a prominent part of the game as well. It kind of makes sense that you would actually take the time to really learn how to use it. I mean, there's a lot, especially if you've hit the green switch block, there is a lot of feathers around. You will often have one. You know, so, and you'll often want to use it.
You know, I feel like the Fire Flower gets the shaft in this game.
It does.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
This was the beginning of a long train of Fire Flyers either being in the game and sucking, or actually, like in Super Mario 64, they just completely leave it out.
But I mean, like in Super Mario Bros. 3, there was real value in the Fire Flower, I felt. And in like some of the boss, you know, some of the baddies, like the Big Bertha that swims back and forth, and it's really dangerous to have the Fire Flower to kill him.
Well, Yoshi really took the place of that.
I think so. Yeah,
that's right. Because Yoshi can neutralize so many enemies that are more dangerous to Mario that you can't touch or whatever.
Spinies.
And they tried to change that by saying, oh, well, it turns into a coin that you can collect. But that's nothing. I think that was a...
Nobody cares about coins anymore.
Yeah. So.
Well, we had another interesting kind of contrast among some of the forum posts. Anand posted, what do you guys think about the spin jump? I feel it's kind of symbolic of the overstuffed nature of Super Mario World compared to the lean, mean Mario Brothers 3. I don't remember the spin jump ever being very necessary except for spinning off Yoshi, which that's actually not very necessary either.
No, because I refuse to do it on humanitarian grounds.
Yeah.
Aren't you just setting him free?
Yeah, exactly.
Not setting him free when it's over
lava. The spin jump is useful. It's not vital in most situations, but...
No, I mean, you could kind of play as if it doesn't exist, almost, but there are... Like I said, that Star Road level, I mean, you have to use it.
Well, but like, it modifies the Fire Flower and the cape. If you use the spin jump to fly up, then you're no longer hitting the ceiling and falling back down. You can stay up on the ceiling for longer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the flight pattern is very different. You don't have this ability to fly back up and down. Instead, it's much more like the raccoon suit was at that point. And in some cases, you would rather do that for accessing secret areas.
Wow, I didn't even know that. I'm gonna have to go try that.
It is quite useful. It really is. And the other big thing is certain objects that you could spin jump onto. I mean, you referenced it earlier with some of the fire things coming out of the lava.
Yeah, yeah.
You can spin jump onto things that you can't touch with the normal jump. So I think even the final battle against Bowser, the giant balls that he bowls onto the screen from out of his airship, don't think you can't jump on those, but you could spin jump on them.
Yeah,
so
you can.
It is pretty damn useful.
Yeah, it's funny. And another person, I didn't pull this quote out, but one person kind of noted that it's the precursor to the butt stomp, which I thought was kind of interesting. I like it better than the butt stomp, because to me the butt stomp always feels like it breaks up the pace.
Yeah,
I
agree.
The spin jump is an interesting topic unto itself, but what I found really interesting about this post from Anand is where he says that he feels that Super Mario World is kind of overstuffed compared to Super Mario Bros. 3 being very lean. But then we had another poster who kind of said that it felt like there were a lot of ideas in 3 that, like the Hammer Brothers suit and the Tanuki suit and, you know, some of these level designs that were, and Karibo shoe is very famous, but a lot of things that were kind of thrown in there and not really used for more than a trivial purpose, or they were just overly difficult to use or overly difficult to find. And so a lot of those ideas that seemed really cool, you didn't really get to use them very much.
Yeah.
And that person praised Super Mario World for having a more kind of a leaner profile of the thing, you know, these are the small number of things we're going to put in the game, but we're going to give you a lot more things to do with them. And like the cape, you know, it certainly has fewer power-ups, but it feels like...
The cape and Yoshi,
I can give you a counter example there, but I think that his point is very valid. But
I think both points are maybe valid.
Honestly, who's using the yellow Yoshi's sand stomp feature? Or red Yoshi's fire breath. In fact, red Yoshi's fire breath is counterproductive because you wind up eating shells when you don't want to. You want to reuse them to fly more or something.
The only time I think of Yoshi's fire breath being useful is if you're about to jump and it's one of those situations where you're kind of jumping towards a formation of Koopa Troopers. And rather than have to time the jump correctly to get over the top of them, you could just spit the fire at them and they're dead. They're coins before you even get there.
Well, I think it's interesting, and again, I think both perspectives are valid. It just sort of depends on what you look, the way you look at it. But I mean, I think there are things in both games that really aren't developed as well, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on which ones you care about.
Yeah.
So we need to wrap this up. Anybody have a final comment for this week? 2IP, you probably won't be here next week. So is there anything else that you wanted to say before we go?
I think I like Super Mario World now more than I did before I revisited it, actually. I think that it's a really expertly crafted game, and Evan and Obi like to talk about video games as art forms, and they start talking about story, how they tell a story, and having denouements or whatever the hell they're talking about. But to me, I think this game is equally valid for that argument, because there is real craft in this game, and you can really look at it and say, what were the designers thinking? Why did they do things this way? Why did they choose to put you in a position where you got to choose from the very beginning? And that also is very much art. I mean, if you can look at things, you know, like, I played this game so much that I was kind of going through the motions playing it, and most of my brain power was going towards, oh, that was an interesting decision. So in my way, I'm looking at this like, you know, like an art critic or something, or believe it or not, a reviewer. Yeah. I actually did review this, and I don't like my own review from the Game Boy. It's too long. But yeah, I'm just really impressed with this game. I really think it's held up very well, and I have more respect for it now than I did before.
Well, that's what you always hope from a retroactive. All right, well, the rest of us should be back next week, and of course, we'll have more of your comments from the forum thread next week, and we'll be back after this break with your listener mail. Okay, we're back for the final segment, your listener mail, and we've got two letters this week. We've actually been getting several very good ones, and just for time constraints here, we're just going to keep it down to two, and we will catch up next time. So, Greg has the first letter.
Right, so this is from RW. I used to feel like you guys do, frustrated with Nintendo's slow schedule for Virtual Console. You see, when I first bought my Wii, I thought it was going to be this great machine that would offer all these classic games to Virtual Console, would inevitably replace all of my Nintendo systems and cartridges dating back to the NES that had been stored in a large treasure chest in my closet. It was going to make my life a little lighter and convenient. I was going to be able to play Yoshi's Island, Dracula X, Marble Madness with the ease of pointing my sleek new Wii remote, but I was wrong. After hearing so long how Tatsunoko vs. Capcom was never coming stateside, I looked into Homebrew and so I could unlock the region on my Wii, but in doing so I discovered the wonderful emulators that are available through the soft mod. Now, having used them, I could say hands down that the NES and Super NES emulators trump what Nintendo's emulators offer. Don't get me wrong, I don't like piracy, it just seemed like life's too short to wait for Nintendo, who's notorious to move like molasses, to release games we want to replay or play for the first time. I for one feel if VC was more proactive, I and many others like myself would have never turned to Homebrew, but it isn't proactive, and now I have all these ROMs of which I once paid, and there are quite a few I never paid for, or at least never had the chance to.
Ooh, there's a lot to this, and I should clarify for people who aren't familiar with this that RW is talking about the Homebrew channel, which is something you can install on your Wii that lets you do a number of things, from playing games from other regions in some cases to playing Homebrew games that people have made, but essentially unlicensed WiiWare type stuff that that people have created for Wii without Nintendo's approval. And then you can run some emulators on there, which are similar to Virtual Console, except you're getting game ROMs from somewhere on the internet.
That's not Nintendo.
Right, which is illegal, basically. Actual running homebrew software is generally considered legal. It's just kind of frowned upon, and sometimes the methods that you have to go through are not too appetizing, maybe we should say. But, you know, it's tough. I mean, I guess one reason that I like Virtual Console, you know, when Virtual Console works the way I would like it to, that we would all like it to, is that I kind of get to do the emulation thing without feeling guilty, you know, mm-hmm. by feeling that I'm contributing back to, hopefully, the people who originally made it, or at least the company that is continuing that property. And so, you know, I like the sense of legitimacy that I get from it.
You can kind of fool yourself into not thinking about it, because there isn't this, you know, open up this file or go to a file menu and open up a ROM or choose a save state. It's very much in the background. And that's what I like about it. I mean, this is nothing new. You could do this on the Xbox. I know people who had, you know, their modded Xbox where they had a crap ton of Genesis and NES and Super Nintendo games.
Oh, and Dreamcast too.
And the Dreamcast
too.
Yeah,
very popular.
Now people are kind of more used to this on Wii because Wii's kind of brought this style of retro gaming to the forefront, but this is nothing new, and I've just never found it terribly appealing. I certainly played a few ROMs on the computer, and of course playing with a keyboard or even with a non-Nintendo controller feels off usually.
Yeah.
Yeah, that always put me off. I've never played much of anything on my PC, but I just didn't like the idea at all. Yeah. So, I mean, that's why Virtual Console was like the earth-shattering for me, because I just hadn't got into this before.
Yeah. And of course, I assume on the Homebrew channel, if you're doing these mods, I assume they've tailored it and tweaked the controls well enough that it feels good with the controllers.
It depends, because I think probably a lot of these would have the ability to set the controls how you want to set them.
Most emulators do.
They would have to, because if they didn't, I mean, people make decisions with these WiiWare games, or rather with these Virtual Console games, of what's the best control layout for each controller.
And that actually is one nice benefit of doing something like what this person's writing about, because if there is a stupid button mapping, you can fix it.
But that's just an issue of the N64 being the N64.
Right.
Having 1,000 face buttons and being designed by Poseidon.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think we can all relate to the frustrations with Virtual Console and slower release schedule and, you know, all of these problems. And even with the price, you know, you may feel like the pricing is sort of unfair. But problem with going into emulation, whether it's through Homebrew Channel or running something on your PC or whatever, is that it's a very slippery slope. And RW really admits to that in this very email, where he says, you know, he started out just playing the games that he had already paid for on a cartridge long ago, or maybe even on a disc. And maybe, you know, maybe it's the games that he wanted to come to Virtual Console and he would have paid for if they'd come out on Virtual Console. But since they haven't, at least not yet, he doesn't feel as guilty about finding the ROM for it. But then he, in the very next breath, he basically says that, and now now I'm playing ROMs of games that I never paid for and that I probably never would have. And I found that with emulators that and very easily accessible ROM collections, that's very easy to get into, is all of a sudden you start, well, let me try this. Oh, I never played this game. I certainly could have. I just never did. And so now I'm going to try this out for 5 minutes. And you end up sort of, it's all-you-can-eat buffet of retro games. It's very, very irresistible. And it's also very illegal, and I'm certainly not condoning it. I think that's one of the problems with getting into that scene, is that all of a sudden you become a consumer of video games who's not really contributing anything back to the system at all. And it opens up some interesting ethical questions of, you know, what about some of these import games that I've never been given an opportunity to pay for legitimately? You know, Earthbound Zero or something like that. Nintendo won't sell it to me, so I don't have to feel as bad about pirating it.
Right.
And I think those are very interesting questions to ask, and there's no way we can conclusively answer them here. No, there's no way anybody can.
Right.
I suppose the interesting aspect of this email is to what extent it makes the policies on the Virtual Console that we sort of mused on a couple of episodes more baffling. Because clearly, as we sort of mentioned, you know, it's not just the sort of people that are really, really desperate to play, you know, huge libraries of retro games that download Virtual Console games, but they're also clearly, those people are going to contribute a huge sort of disproportionate amount of the revenue that would accrue from Virtual Console, you know, because the select group of people that would download, you know, maybe even hundreds of titles theoretically over the span of the service life, and yet, you know, you're kind of opening the door for them to say, well, I didn't want to, but you pushed me to it, you know, however they want to rationalize it.
Right.
So again, this policy of trickling them out is not only kind of odd, but perhaps even sort of self-mutilating in the commercial sense.
But if you go to the other end of the spectrum, is what we're talking about with Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection. If you're given 40 games, well, where do I start? And that's what happens when you do this piracy of all of a sudden you have 500 games that you're just, well, I don't know what to play.
Well, the thing is, though, the frustrating part is that there's no rhyme or reason to the way that games are being trickled out on virtual console.
That's true.
It's not like it's a guy. It's not like it's a tour of gaming no, history.
It's still scattershot.
Yeah. It's all over the place, basically.
And they just keep adding more and more systems without coming anywhere close to completing the selection on any of them.
Because obviously, you know, we had the big discussion on the virtual console, and you know, trying to explain some of these things, and this isn't something that we considered on the air. And it is pertinent because the fact is I'm sure there are, you know, dollars being foregone because of this sort of thing. And then I'm sure they're aware of that as well. And yet they still make the decisions that they do. I mean, it's quite interesting sort of context. But I would like to say something sort of positive about the virtual console recently. So we were me in particular was promoting the fact that we don't get anything from Western publishers. And then we found out that LucasArts are starting to bring their games to virtual console, beginning with the Super Star Wars trilogy. So, you know, progress is something.
Absolutely. And those are good games. They're very hard.
Unevenly difficult.
Yeah, because once you get... That's why I'm waiting for Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, because you have the lightsaber from the beginning, and it makes a big difference in how playable
those
the game
early
is
levels, like the Sandcrawler and some of the things,
they're brutal.
Really impossible. They're so difficult. It's so much easier later on. It's a really bizarre difficulty curve. I didn't play either of the latter two, so I'd be quite excited to play those.
And of course, I've got my fingers crossed for Rogue Squadron on N64.
Yeah, that'd be a watershed moment, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be a good selection.
I mean, so Star Wars on N64, pretty kind of indelibly associated with it when you think of Rogue Squadron, Shatters the Empire at launch, and they bundled Podracer with it.
It's a very good version of Podracer, actually.
It's the only good version of Podracer.
Well, Dreamcast is, I think, considered the definitive, but N64 is a very good version of Podracer. And that's actually a very good racing game. And I think Shadows of the Empire is better than people give it credit for.
That game has seriously aged poorly, though.
It probably has.
I just remember beating one of the bosses in the junkyard because I fell through the ground and I was standing under him and shoot his feet.
It was buggy, but it has unlimited jetpacks, so you know where I stand.
You know, Johnny, that cape is an unlimited jetpack. Super Mario.
It's not. It's really not. But yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Greg, and I think that does show some kind of promise. Although I think the initiative for the Star Wars Virtual Console stuff came more from LucasArts than it did Nintendo, but I'm not complaining at all.
No, I mean, let's just hope hopefully it goes well, and obviously not everything's got the strength of the Star Wars license behind it, but it could be, you know, a bit of a sort of gateway to more Western publishers partnering on this sort of stuff.
And just to wrap up the piracy discussion before we move on to the next letter, I do think that although the sort of trickle-out market strategy that Nintendo's taken with Virtual Console was interesting, and I think it does have certain advantages, like we said, I think it's mostly due to necessity of obtaining all these licenses and working with the publishers and getting the emulators just right for each individual game. And I think really everyone would be better off if Nintendo could and did go with the iTunes model, which is basically build up a huge library, just add things as soon as they're available, and make it more about, look at this vast collection, you can get anything you want at any time. And when you think about it, I mean, the stuff like Homebrew Channel, although certainly has its legitimate uses, the idea of people using emulators for playing pirated games, you know, massive collections of stuff, is very similar to what happened with Napster and the music industry. And that model of rampant piracy of music was very seriously dampened by the success of iTunes, by the fact that people say, you know, if I could get this stuff very conveniently by paying a small fee, I would. I'm happy to pay for it as long as it's easy to do and the system works well and it's attractive to do so. Yeah. And I think maybe the next future generation of virtual console or whatever competition arises for it has the potential to be the iTunes of retro games.
But we already have, I mean, we have stuff like GameTap that has a lot of these games out there.
It's really not the same because GameTap has kind of a bit of a random selection as well. It may be somewhat larger than Virtual Console.
It is much larger than Virtual Console.
But there are a lot of things on Virtual Console that you'll never see on GameTap, particularly from Nintendo itself. And then the other thing is, I think the quality of emulation is quite different between GameTap and Virtual Console. So I see where you're coming from. That's also a subscription model, so it's very different than from the a la carte method of iTunes and Virtual mm-hmm. Console. So there's a lot of different models going on here, and I hope over time that we can move into better, legitimate ways to play these retro games. All right, we have one more letter, and James is going
to
read it.
So unknown, in quotes, writes...
He's a person that willfully doesn't leave his name on every
it's
occasion.
It's a Pokemon.
He explicitly states that he is not going to leave us his name. Yes, writes, "Hey guys, I was wondering if you could talk about what will happen when Miyamoto's gone. The man is not only a sort of celebrity in the industry, but he also continues to create some of the most influential games. Do you guys think someone, or several people, would step and sort of take his place? And what do you think about developers and producers of these games becoming celebrities like this? Is it good or bad?"
This has already kind of happened, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much stepped aside in a lot of his
he's
major
more
development
supervisory
tasks.
Than he was for once upon a time.
Well, what's happened is individuals have taken over individual series.
In some ways, in sad ways, like I really respect Iguchi. I don't remember his given name, but he going back to Super Mario World, he was one of the lead level designers for Mario 3 and Super Mario World, and he directed Star Fox. And like I had a chance to interview him, and he's like, "I'm not interested in making those games anymore. I want to make Animal Crossing. I want to make communication games."
Well, he worked on New Super Mario Brothers and probably on the one for Wii as well. Iguchi has his hands in a lot of stuff. He worked on Wii Sports Resort. He's a very high-level producer. He's actually a lot like Miyamoto in terms of supervising several different projects at any
yeah,
given time.
Yeah, that's true.
But I do think it's a little sad that Miyamoto is now more of a manager, because if you think about it, he definitely directed Super Mario 64.
And Ocarina of Time.
And Ocarina. Right. After Ocarina, it gets pretty fuzzy, and I'm not actually sure that he's directed any games, and being the director is very, you know, that is the one game that you work on for that time. I mean, you might be a sort of a consultant on a couple other projects. They might bring you in every now and then to look at something, but basically you're devoting all your time to that one game, and you really, as the director, you really have a lot of creative control over the direction of what that game ends up being, whereas a producer is more of a supervisory thing. You're kind of giving general comments, you're making sure everything stays on schedule. So that's more of what Miyamoto does now, and I feel like his influence, although still very much present at Nintendo, and he does make a lot of high-level decisions about which games get made and when it's time to up in the tea table, as they say, and, you know, kind of start over, or, you know, this game's really going in the wrong direction. But I feel like his influence in terms of game design, the stuff that really made him famous in the first place with Mario and Zelda and Donkey Kong, I feel like that has been diluted very much.
Yeah, it's diffuse now in a way that it wouldn't have been years ago. But I mean,
right.
It may well exist in ways that you don't see very easily. But sure. Perhaps, you know, the some of the good work that goes on these other projects that, you know, he's not really directly doing is part of the other, what he's done over the years developing, you know, and putting together studios and all this sort of stuff. So, I mean, he's clearly still very important. And to some extent, you know, when you talk about the celebrity angle, you know, the fact is, whatever he's doing at Nintendo, he's going to be their icon for as long as he's there. And if he, you know, were to retire or he were to pass away, he would be missed in that capacity
yes.
by necessity, because that's who he is. He is that man. And he did do all that stuff years ago. So in that sense, he is irreplaceable. You'll never have someone like him again, because what's special about him is because he was so near to the genesis of console gaming being so successful, whereas future sort of stars are not going to have that association with the earliest memories of things like Super Mario Brothers and Zelda.
Well, what's interesting is that even some of the people who were, I guess, almost protégés and have taken over franchises have kind of stepped back from the franchises themselves. I mean, it shows you how he is somewhat removed in capacity.
Well, I think it's funny you should mention that, because I think there was a quote about Super Mario Galaxy 2 that suggested that, you know, Koizumi, the chap that directed this first one, and, you know, the guy that tries to sneak story into those games, basically. it was a quote that implied that he is not the director of Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Maybe Koizumi's gone on to work on the next Sonic game or Donkey Kong Jungle Beat 2.
Yeah, there
or
we go.
Like
that's
that.
It.
Is here it is. It says, I'm working with Mr. Koizumi, who was the director of Super Mario Galaxy and producer of Super Mario Galaxy 2. So that's quite explicit, actually.
Yeah.
It's more explicit than I remembered. So even, as James said, I mean, how many sort of steps removed he is now from the most, you know, hands-on kind of capacity of game design is
right.
quite evident. But I still think you feel his influence, and like I said, I mean, he's a real one-off. There won't be anyone that's sort of revered in the same way again.
There might even be a flip side to the situation in that I feel like if Nintendo's goal in moving Miyamoto to a managerial role was to sort of spread his influence out into all the products that are developed at Nintendo, I think they were fairly successful in that. I mean, it was diluted somewhat, but I think in general, most of the stuff that comes out of Nintendo now feels Miyamoto-like. And I just kind of want to propose that maybe that's not always a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like if you go back to the days of NES and even Super NES, Nintendo internally was releasing some products that felt significantly different, still very good, but they really felt different than the stuff that was coming out of Miyamoto's group. And I feel like that sense has been lost now. And most of the stuff that you get from Nintendo that really feels un-Miyamoto-like, it tends to be stuff that's developed offshores, outside
yeah,
Japan.
I think the only real exception is maybe like the WarioWare series, which seems very much removed from Miyamoto.
Yeah. I mean, those guys still do their own thing, the R&D one people. I mean,
yeah.
You know, even insofar as, you know, obviously Team Ninja's developing the new Metroid, but it was R&D one's idea.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess I could see it, you know, there's a certain homogenization that may have occurred, you know, over time.
A little bit, I feel like. It's funny to me in that you see a lot of interviews with Miyamoto where they sort of name him as like the man behind Wii Sports Resort, the guy in charge of the Metroid series, or the guy who does Zelda. When you think about like Mario Galaxy 2, how much involvement does Miyamoto really have in that game? Very little, I would guess.
I mean, I suppose to some extent it's one of these things in his capacity, if the feeling took him to get hands-on and you know, and if he had the time available to him, he could do it. I mean, clearly he would have the authority. And
the point is that they're throwing that term around when they shouldn't, because he's not the man behind.
I've said this before, but he's become kind of Nintendo's Tom Clancy, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, it goes back to the thing about the celebrity in the letter, doesn't it? You know, that,
right.
that not only is he, you know, obviously this recognizable icon because he's so indelibly associated with, you know, Nintendo's rise and console gaming and the beloved series that went into that, but Nintendo actively cultivates it now.
Right.
I guess the only sort of deviation from that more recently is that he didn't appear on stage at E3 this year, but he still, you know, has his round table or whatever. I mean, you know, and like you said, they still make sure he gets in on a lot of the sort of, you know, Iwata asks, even if he's pretty tenuously linked to some of them. I mean,
mm-hmm.
He was pretty sort of in crucial part of the one on Link's crossbow
trailer. Oh, yeah. Isn't there
I just kind of struggled to see that this was some big project that was eating away his time.
Isn't there one where you just become aware of the fact he's in the room about halfway through the interview? Like, there's no real reference of him there until suddenly he says something that sounds almost condescending to Iwata. What the fuck?
You know, in the early 2000s, when Iwata was at HAL, right before he came to Nintendo, he was a developer on some of HAL's games that Miyamoto was probably supervising for
mm-hmm.
Nintendo.
Right.
So, depending on how you look at it, Iwata probably worked for Miyamoto at some point.
Maybe not officially, but
Iwata rose to power very quickly once he moved over to Nintendo.
The two of them have at least a public relationship that's kind of weird. Like when you
I think it's hilarious.
Though, like, one will talk and the other one will basically go, no, that's not exactly how it went. It went like this.
Well, we could probably talk a lot more about the whole developer celebrity thing. I feel like that really deserves more discussion than we have time to give to
it. Kind of inevitable as games get bigger, more mainstream, that companies, the developers, the studios, they get more proactive about marketing the games, and they, you know, they try to, especially with new IP, for instance, you'll want to connect it to something else that somebody's done or whatever. But Miyamoto
sure.
is something different.
I agree. I think he's kind of on his on he, a different
it's because
level.
He's got this, you know, unique place in the heritage of gaming itself, and Nintendo wants to continue to trade off that sort of stuff. Yeah, so it's just something like Wii Music, you know. It's like, well, let's get Miyamoto out in front of that to kind of, you know, imply that right. It's, you know, that it holds up to those standards of quality. I mean, you know, of course they're going to do that, but the point is, in the future, if Miyamoto were to step aside or whatever, you could never do that as successfully with, you know, any of these subordinates that are there now.
No.
Because they just wouldn't have the resonance.
Well, what I was wondering is, you say it's kind of inevitable that that would continue, but I seem to recall it more when I was younger. Like, because you'd see somebody's name on the front of the box. Like, I gave a damn that this guy made this game. And I think now it's more of a marketing gimmick, but I think then it was more, this was their way of saying, I want credit for my title. So, who was it?
David Crane and
yeah.
Roberta Williams and stuff like that. Yeah.
I mean, their names were on the box cover. I mean, even you're never going to see Shigeru Miyamoto's The Legend of Zelda. I mean,
you don't have to be. The thing is about that is you don't have to be so unsubtle about it today to do it, though.
No.
You know, in those days, the channels of information weren't open to tell people as easily as just sticking the name on the box. Whereas now you've got developer blogs and video interviews on websites.
And when it is done now, it feels really bizarre, like American McGee's stuff and, you know, Sid Meier's Civilization mm-hmm. 4 or whatever. It seems kind of out of place now.
Because American McGee made that god-awful Escape from L.A. game.
Oh sure. Yeah. It's interesting, and I do often think about what will happen to Nintendo when Miyamoto eventually leaves the company for whatever reason. You know, he's in his upper 50s, I think, at this point. Let's say in 10 years he decides it's time to retire. I mean, I don't think Nintendo's screwed at that point, but I do start to wonder about, well, you know, how much longer can they keep up this level of quality in their games?
In case you're wondering, he's 56.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously started so young, really.
To
achieve some of these, you know, seminal things, you know, going back mm-hmm. to Donkey Kong and all that. Obviously, he was very young in the company and just a young man. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's what's so unique about him, is that he spans so long, and yet he probably won't be done for a little while yet.
Maybe a different way of looking at that is not so much worrying about what happens when Miyamoto leaves Nintendo, but what if eventually Miyamoto gets tired of this whole management working on 10 projects at once, and he says, you know what, give me the chance to actually make my own game. You know, maybe there's some corporate problems with that, maybe they won't let him, but let's say he does. I mean, do you think that would be his masterpiece? I mean, would it really make a difference if he went back and just directed a game? He says, you know what, I'm going to make the next Mario game. I'm going to do this, and I'm not going to worry about all the other stuff that Nintendo's doing. This will be my game.
It depends. You kind of think it would be something a little more personal, maybe.
Yeah,
and what on earth that would be is hard to...
Would we be able to play something that is more personal to him than Pikmin?
I'm afraid he'd go back and make Cabbage.
No, Cabbage.
Marionette, something like that. But it'd be awesome to see Miyamoto's last hurrah, you know? What would he do if he had that much creative control and that much direct involvement with a single game? What would it be like? Would it even be something that we would want at this point?
So it could be sort of like some of the stuff that came out for the DS. You know, it was clearly designed almost as a way of saying, well, you can do this with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think my understanding is he does have input into hardware, especially the kind of hardware that Nintendo's going after now, where it's very sort of experience-driven design. I mean, they've been burning through all this R&D cash lately. I mean, you know, what the hell are they doing? I mean, because they aren't spending all that R&D cash to get the graphics of the Wii up to Xbox 360 levels. You know, that wouldn't be very expensive.
Well, and you have a great point there. That's one of the really unusual things about Miyamoto. It's really what makes him unique in the world of video games, is that he is so closely associated with software, with games, with game design, and yet he also has an incredible influence over hardware design for Nintendo.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anyone else in the gaming industry who has their hands in both pots like that. And what it allows him to do is not only design games that use the hardware in very original ways, but also to design the hardware in such a way that it is designed for certain kinds of games. I think that maybe has not worked out so great the past couple generations.
Well, I think some of this comes down to kind of the focus test mindset of developing something versus the guy or team with a vision. When Microsoft and Sony are developing a new system, you can be damn sure that they solicit with their good third-party partners and say, hey, what would you like to see in this?
They will after the PS3.
For sure, but I think Nintendo's visions have been maybe a little too narrow in some cases.
I mean,
I think the reason Miyamoto is given so much hardware input these days is because, you know, he back in the days of N64, he really insisted on there being an analog joystick on that controller because this game he was directing, Mario 64, needed that kind of input. And then after that, going forward, they kind of brought him in earlier in the process, I think, in designing GameCube controller and then really the entire Wii system. You know, that maybe that's not the best way to design a controller. You can certainly design a very cool, fun controller by taking that
Batarang
philosophy, but it does create compatibility issues with known concepts. And I think also Miyamoto is very much for this idea that the controller sort of drives game design, and it's a bit like saying that the language you're writing in determines what kind of book you can write. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it has some influence over that kind of thing, but I'm not necessarily in agreement that the controller should determine the types of games that can be put on your system. And because, among other things, one of the problems that comes out of that is that you end up requiring a lot of alternative controllers in order to facilitate the games that people actually want, which is exactly what has happened with Wii.
And Nintendo makes more money because of it, so it's the problem.
Hey.
Yeah, I mean, they're fine with it. I'm not necessarily
Red and his European counterparts are going to have a horse riding device.
Supposedly.
Just the image that came with that patent is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life. It looks woefully inappropriate.
Okay, well, I'm just going to have to cut off the discussion because this is why we only did two letters this week. Thank you very much for the great letters, and I would definitely encourage everyone to keep writing in. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and once again, please, if you want your letter read on the show, don't send it to the mailbag because we're going to reserve those for the actual mailbag now. So be sure to actually send it to the podcast address, and I'm going to start putting a direct email link in the podcast article. So if you have a hard time remembering RFN, you can go to the article and click a link and do it that way. But please keep sending in those great letters, and we'll have more of them next week. Before we go, TYP,
yes,
you have your own podcast.
I do have a podcast. It's Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. I try to do it every other week. This week, I have to take a hiatus just for other reasons. But check it out. Johnny's on sometimes. James is on sometimes. Sometimes we have some other people. Greg's been on once or twice. Check it out. It's a lot of fun. It's a combination of banter about games like you hear here and good video game music. So check it out.
It's a lot of fun.
Check it out.
I always look forward to listening to it, even when I'm not on it. So that
I think you're supposed to say even when you are on it, actually.
Yeah, well.
I look forward to it, and then I'll listen at work, and then I'll get all upset that I can't remember a game and I look stupid.
Mm. Yeah. It's really fun to participate.
Damn it,
even
what
though
game is
nobody's
this?
Keeping score. And of course, we also have a third podcast now, the Newscast. You know, Neil was on the show last week, and he probably mentioned that they're trying to get the podcast up in iTunes, and I just checked today, it is up there now.
Oh.
So if you don't like downloading MP3s and having to drag them over to your iPod or whatever, you can very easily go to iTunes, search for NWR Newscast. It pops up right there. You subscribe, and now you're getting it every week or every 2 weeks, just like Radio Free Nintendo. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for being here, TYP and James and Greg. And like I said, we should have John back next week. We will continue the discussion on Super Mario World, so it's definitely not too late to jump into the forums and be a part of that. And all right, end of show. Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
So long.
I hate you, Mario. I said it. I hate you. I hate your galaxy. I said it. I said it. You want it?
You hate his third brother?
Yep. I hate every single of the thousands of Mario games I've played.
Stupid little raccoon tail. Yeah, he's
78 Mario games he's played. Hates
him. Yep. Every last one. Take that, world.